All right. Hello, everyone. And very happy Wednesday. It's good to see y'all. Maybe I'll turn my video camera on because something we kind of need to get used to, I guess. Oh, but I'm in the dark. You can't really see me. I'll leave it on anyway. But if I was really doing video for people to look at, I would have to put the light in front of me instead of behind me. It's helpful behind me because I can see my book better. And I am reading tonight from conversation number 15, the Yanani. And I Am That talks with Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. And here we go. The questioner says, without God's power, nothing can be done. Even you would not be sitting here and talking to us without him. Nisargadatta says, all is his doing, no doubt. What is it to me, since I want nothing? What can God give me or take away from me? What is mine, and was mine, even when God was not. Of course, it is a very tiny little thing, a speck, the sense I am, the fact of being. This is my own place. Nobody gave it to me. The earth is mine. What grows on it is God's. So I don't have anything to say about that. It's kind of silliness to me. Sometimes I have to admit, sometimes I think Nisargadatta is just, being a bit of a smart ass. Here he is talking about a God, God, like God didn't give me anything. The earth is mine, but what grows on it is God's. And I guess we'll have to get further into it to see why he's saying these things. But to me, again, this kind of talk is just confusing. So let's see where we go with this. The questioner. Did God take the earth on rent from you? So apparently the questioner feels the same way. Nisargadatta says, the earth is mine, what grows on it is God's. And the questioner's like, so is God renting the earth from you? I mean, how does he grow his crops on your earth? So it'll be fun to see where this conversation goes. So did God take the earth on rent from you? And Nisargadatta says, God is my devotee and did all this for me. Now, I will tell you that I do not know where Nisargadatta is going with this, and we shall find out. However, there is some understanding that I have of this sentence, God is my devotee and did all this for me. As blasphemous as that may sound to some people, and as arrogant as that may sound to some people, there's a truth to that. If we look at the four principles of God, and if we call the Creator God, right, the Creator, that would be the third principle of God. The third principle of God is the creative process, therefore, it is the Creator. Consciousness is the second principle of God. It is before the creative principle. And in fact, it is very fair to say that the creative principle serves consciousness. Consciousness, which is the, I sometimes call consciousness the son of God, consciousness is the only direct. I don't like to use the word creation. I like to use the word evolution. I think creation is misleading. Consciousness is the only direct evolution out of the first principle of God, with the first principle of God being life awareness, and consciousness being being what came out of that. And consciousness, as you know, has the ability to be aware of. But in order to be aware of, it needs something to be aware of. And so the creative principle was the next evolution. It came out of consciousness in order to be the mechanism that creates manifestation or objects, which gives consciousness something to be aware of. So if I know myself as consciousness, and when I say I, if the word I means consciousness, then it is very fair to say that the creative principle serves me. And if we're going to call the creative principle God, well, then, as arrogant as it sounds, it would be very fair and truthful to say that God serves me, as long as that me is that second principle of God, consciousness. So we'll see where this goes. But to me, that last statement is not as silly as some of these previous statements that Nisarg Gadatta has made in this conversation. So the questioner again, also recognizing the silliness in Nisarg Gadatta's statements, said, "Did God take the earth on rent from you?" And Nisarg Gadatta says, "God is my devotee and did all of this for me." And then the questioner says, "Is there no God apart from you?" And Nisarg Gadatta says, "How can there be?" Here we go. "I am is the root. God is the tree. Who am I to worship and what for?" So here, Nisarg Gadatta is just confirming everything that I just mentioned. I am is synonymous with consciousness, the second principle of God. And so Nisarg Gadatta is saying, "I am is the root. God, or the creative principle, is the tree that grows out of that root." So this is what Nisarg Gadatta is really referring to, even though he started it in a rather silly way. this is what he is referring to, that the creative principle comes after consciousness. Consciousness is superior to the creative principle. So, is there no God apart from you? And Nisargadatta says, "How can there be? I am is the root. God is the tree. Who am I to worship? And what for?" The questioner says, "Are you the devotee or the object of devotion?" And Nisargadatta says, "I am neither. I am devotion itself." And that again is a sentence that I understand very easily. It would not be right to call me the devotee of something, especially when I means consciousness. But it's also not true. There's nothing in the I am that wants worship. So I'm also not an object of devotion. But to say I am devotion itself, that's like saying I am love, I am gratitude, I am happiness, I am joy, right? So I'm not a devotee of anything. I'm not an object of devotion. I am devotion itself. The questioner says, there is not enough devotion in the world. And Nisargadatta says, you are always after the improvement of the world. Do you really believe that the world is waiting for you to be saved? The questioner says, I just do not know how much I can do for the world. All I can do is to try. Is there anything else you would like me to do? So I'm wondering now if Nisargadatta knows this particular devotee. Maybe, maybe not, but it kind of sounds like they might be a little familiar with each other. Nisargadatta says, without you, is there a world? And I'll continue reading the rest of this answer in a moment, but I think that this is something worth contemplating. Without you, is there a world? Now, when we think of ourselves as bodies in a world, then we believe that I, the body, can die, and most certainly the world continues without me. But what if we look at ourselves as awareness or consciousness instead of as a body? And let's not look at ourselves as individual awareness or individual consciousness, which we believe belongs to a body, and when the body dies, that individual awareness or individual consciousness ends. Let's not look at ourselves that way. Let's look at ourselves as awareness or consciousness. I am, I want you just to do this with me. I am the totality of awareness. I am the totality of consciousness. Now, if you accept that you are the totality of awareness or the totality of consciousness, then without you, can there be a world? And the answer is no. Without something to be aware of a world, there is no world. You know, it's kind of like the old philosophical question, if a tree falls in the woods and there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a noise? And it's very similar to that question. If that question still kind of makes you think of yourself as an individual. And what I'm asking you to do is to think of yourself as the totality of awareness, or the totality of consciousness. If it weren't for you, there could be no world. And it's just as we saw before, consciousness is superior to or primary to not only the creative principle, but anything that comes out of the creative principle, which of course the world of manifestation comes out of the creative principle. So you are the foundation on which the world is built, which might be what Nisargadatta was trying to point to a moment ago when he said, the earth is mine and what grows on it is God's. Kind of a weird way to say it, you know, but it might be what he meant. I am the foundation on which manifestation appears, right? So again, the questioner is saying, I just do not know how much I can do for the world. The questioner is concerned about the world, just like many people are. All I can do is to try. Is there anything else you would like me to do? And Nisargadatta says, without you, is there a world? You know all about the world, but about yourself, you know nothing. You yourself are the tools of your work. You have no other tools. Why don't you take care of the tools before you think of the work? All right, so again, sometimes Nisargadatta seems to speak in riddles, but I do understand this riddle. So, if I am someone who is concerned about the state of the world, if healing the world somehow is an objective of mine, then the best thing I can do to help heal the world is to heal myself. As A Course in Miracles would say, accept the atonement for myself, right? The miracle worker's sole responsibility is to accept the atonement for himself. Or as Ramana Maharshi says, the greatest service you can render the world is your own self-realization. And that is, of course, as you know, because you are consciousness, although you know you may mistake yourself for a person in a world, regardless of how you perceive yourself, you are consciousness. And what you give your believing attention to manifests in the world. So if you are angry at the President of the United States, at your mother, at your neighbor, you know, it doesn't really matter what you are angry at yourself for not meeting your own expectations. It doesn't really matter what you're angry at. If you are giving believing attention to an anger energy, that anger energy is going into the world and angry scenes are manifesting. You know, I guess today in the United States of America, there were two more mass shootings. You know, maybe that's a manifestation of anger energy, right? And so let's just narrow things down a little bit. You know, my English teacher in high school used to always say, let's narrow the subject, you know, narrow your subjects. Let's narrow our subject. Let's say the only thing that we want to change about the world is the mass shootings in the United States of America, right? You know, it's just gotten ridiculous, it's gotten too common, and it's time that somebody does something about that. Well, it doesn't matter, you know, what political groups you become involved in, it doesn't matter how you vote, it really doesn't matter what you do. If you're angry while you do it, you know, if you're angry at those people who won't support gun control, or you're angry at those people who think gun control is the answer when you think it's something else. We need more guns. Sorry, I got a text I got to say yay to. Jacqueline Eckert, if you are listening, Justin has signed. I'll say yay. What this means is we now have an agreement, for those of you who are listening, yeah, Jacqueline says yay, we now have an agreement to close the retreat house in about 2.5 weeks. Is that right? October 5th. Yeah, so Justin has signed. But, you know, whether I think, you know, no matter what I think the solution is, if I'm getting involved in that in an angry way because I'm consciousness, and because my believing attention is going on anger, I'm sending that anger energy out into the world and actually participating in the creation of appearances just like the one that I say I want to end, right? So what Nisargadatta is telling this man again, he's saying, you know all about the world. You know, I could say, you know everything. You think you know everything about these shootings in America and what needs to be done in order to stop them. You know all about the world. But about yourself, you know nothing. You don't realize that your anger is participating in the creation of these appearances. You yourself are the tools of your work. If you want more peace in the world, you need to become peaceful. Right? Your way of being is the creative process. You yourself are the tools of your work. You have no other tools. You know, your way of being is the only tool that is really, truly at your disposal, not the political system, right? Not, you know, protesting. Your way of being, it's the only tool at your disposal. So why don't you take care of the tools before you think of the work? It's kind of like saying, why not accept the atonement for yourself, or be concerned only about your own self-realization? Now the questioner says, of course not understanding, I can wait while the world cannot, right? Like, you know, there's nothing that wrong with me. The problem is out there. You know, what good is it going to do to, quote, fix me? It's the world that needs fixing, right? I can wait while the world cannot. Nisargadatta says, by not inquiring, you keep the world waiting, right? Since your way of being is the creative process, by not practicing inquiry into your thoughts and your perceptions and purifying yourself, you keep the world waiting. The world cannot be peaceful until you are peaceful first. By not inquiring, you keep the world waiting. The questioner says, waiting for what? And Nisargadatta says, for somebody who can save it. Right? For the enlightened mind, for somebody who can save it. The questioner says, God runs the world. God will save it. And Nisargadatta says, that's what you say. Did God come and tell you that the world is his creation and concern and not yours? And of course, this is a confusion that is very easy to understand. You know, the questioner thinks he's a person in the world. Nisargadatta knows that he is consciousness, right? Prior to the creative process, and in this way, prior to God. Right? Prior to God. God, you know, the creative process, but right now that's what we're calling God. God delivers what consciousness places its attention on. The creative process delivers what consciousness places its attention on. The creative process works for consciousness. And it will always deliver whatever consciousness puts its attention on. And so if we want the manifestation to appear differently, if that is our concern, well then the proper response to that concern is to clean house right here. Pay attention to what I place my attention on, because God will respond to that. The questioner says, why should it be my sole concern? Nisargadatta says, consider the world in which you live Who else knows about it? And of course, now Nisargadatta is talking about manifestation as it is seen through the filter of this individual mind. Right? No two individual minds are exactly alike, and in that way, no two worlds are exactly alike. So consider the world in which you live. Who else knows about it? And the questioner says, you know. Everybody knows. Nisargadatta says, did anybody come from outside of your world to tell you? I and everybody else appear and disappear in your world. We are all at your mercy. Heather says, hallelujah. This is Heather is our realtor. And this retreat house, I'm sure you guys know, has been a bit of a long journey. So now we're getting a hallelujah from our realtor. I mean, to be honest, even a few hours ago, we weren't sure we were going to make a deal. So so it's looking good. It's looking good. So again, you know, Nisargadatta is talking to this person and really explaining, although I don't think, in my humble opinion, not explaining really well. You know, I think he speaks in, like I said, he speaks in puzzles, he speaks in riddles, and I think it's hard for people to follow. But what he's attempting to explain, again, is what I call interdependent co-arising, or the code, or the flow, or, you know, whatever words you want to put to it, that again, what we give our believing attention to writes the script of the world, and the script of the world then just happens. And so the believing attention is where the change needs to occur. And he's saying, you know, we're all at your mercy. And of course, you know, he's talking to one man, but if you take you in that sentence to mean consciousness, not one man, you know, that's completely true. The entire world is at the mercy of where consciousness places its attention. And each and every one of us, as apparent individuals, really as consciousness, but as apparent individuals, have to take responsibility for that. The miracle worker's sole responsibility is to accept the atonement for himself. The greatest service you can render the world is your own self-realization. So again, Nisargadatta says, we are all at your mercy. You know, really referring to the consciousness. But the questioner says, I cannot be so bad. I exist in your world as you exist in mine. Nisargadatta says, you have no evidence of my world. You are completely wrapped up in the world of your own making. And that's a very true statement too. You know, unless you are enlightened yourself, you cannot know the world the enlightened person sees or knows. You know, even, you know, I'm not going to come anywhere near claiming to be enlightened. That would be silly. But, you know, certainly my mind is much more purified than the average mind in the world. And as a result, I know for a fact that I experience the world differently. And I also know for a fact that the people that I know, can't see how I see. And the way I know that is by their comments. Like, you know, I don't remember specifically, but like with my mom this week, you know, there, oh, I remember one thing. It's not very important, but I remember it. You know, I was going down the highway, kind of typical, like about 5 miles over the speed limit. And this car just went, zoom, like real right past me really fast. And I went, whoa, he's going fast. And my mom says, well, don't judge him. I remember thinking, you know, I thought it was kind of funny because there was an assumption that there was a judgment in my exclamation, you know, where really it was just a, just an exclamation. Whoa, he's going fast. But there was no sense of judgment in it. But you know, one who judges regularly will perceive judgment. And if you are merely observing without judgment, they can't see that. They can't know that. They don't even understand that. Right? It's just not possible for them. And so when Nisargadatta, who, you know, apparently, now how could I know for a fact, but apparently is what we call fully enlightened, he sees in whatever way a fully enlightened mind sees, and a mind that is not fully enlightened can't understand that. It can only see through the filter of its mind. Right? It sees judgment, it sees separation, you know, it sees fearful things, it sees good and bad things, it sees desired and undesired, and it cannot comprehend that the enlightened mind does not see any of that. So when Nisargadatta says, "You have no evidence of my world, you are completely wrapped up in the world of your own making," again, that is just a very fair statement. The questioner, again, not understanding, says, "I see completely, but hopelessly." You know, so he says, "I see the world," you know, he's basically saying, "I see the world clearly, but I, you know, it's, you know, there's just so much out there that's bad. You know, it's hopeless, right?" So he doesn't understand that Nisargadatta sees completely differently than him. I see completely, but hopelessly. Nisargadatta says, "Within the prison of your world appears a man who tells you that the world of painful contradictions which you have created is neither continuous nor permanent, and is based on a misapprehension. He pleads with you to get out of it by the same way which you got into it. You got into it by forgetting what you are, and you will get out of it by knowing yourself as you are." So, you know, basically Nisargadatta is saying, "I know what you don't know. Listen to me." I love it in NTI when the Holy Spirit says, and it says it often, "Listen to me," right? And that's what Nisargadatta is saying here. "I know what you don't know. Listen to me." So again, you got into your world by forgetting what you are, and you will get out of it by knowing yourself as you are. The questioner says, "In what way does it affect the world?" Nisargadatta says, "When you are free of the world, you can do something about it. As long as you are a prisoner of it, you are helpless to change it. On the contrary, whatever you do will aggravate the situation." Right? And that again is because people do not understand. You know, like if I choose the side of gun control, again, there were two more shootings today. What the heck is wrong with our politicians? Dang that Republican Party, don't they know we need gun control? My God, how many more people have to die? You see, I don't understand that all of that energy is going into the world and painting the exact appearances I'm upset about, right? I think I'm being helpful by getting angry, but to the contrary, I'm doing exactly the opposite. I am aggravating the situation. So within the prison of your world appears a man who tells you that the world of painful contradictions which you have created is neither continuous or permanent. That means it doesn't have to be the way it is. And it's based on a misapprehension, right? A misunderstanding of what you are. He pleads with you to get out of it by the same way which you got into it. You got into it by forgetting what you are, and you will get out of it by knowing yourself as you are. When you are free of the world, you can do something about it. As long as you are a prisoner of it, you are helpless to change it. On the contrary, whatever you do will aggravate the situation. The questioner says, righteousness will set me free. Nisargadatta says, righteousness will undoubtedly make you and your world a comfortable, even happy place. But what is the use? There is no reality in it. It cannot last. Now, something else I don't quite understand. I don't understand, what they mean by righteousness, in this case. I'm going to go ahead and just look up righteousness, see if I can figure out exactly what Nisargadatta is saying here. The quality of being morally right. Okay, I suppose, let's look at this sentence again. Righteousness will undoubtedly make you and your world a comfortable, even happy place. But what is the use? There is no reality in it. It cannot last. So, and I just wanted to point this out. This is a best guess at what Nisargadatta is saying here. So take it as a guess. I think Nisargadatta is saying if you live, according to your conscience, if you live morally right, undoubtedly, you're going to be more happy. But that's not the same thing as self-realization. And the personality that learned to become righteous and learned to become happy is going to die, right? Like the self-realization is something more than righteousness. So certainly righteousness is helpful, to your experience in this world. But what I'm speaking of is beyond this temporary world. And that's my best guess at what he's saying here. I'll read it again. You can do your own guessing. Righteousness will undoubtedly make you and your world a comfortable, even happy place. But what is the use? There is no reality in it. It cannot last. The questioner says, God will help. Nisargadatta says, to help you, God must know of your existence. Now here, God, the word God could be moving. Before, when the word God was being used, it referred to the creative principle. But now the word God might refer to life awareness, the first principle of God. Because life awareness is not aware of manifestation. Life awareness is only aware of life awareness. So let's read more and see what he's saying here. To help you, God must know of your existence, but you and your world are dream states. In dream, you may suffer agonies. No one knows them and no one can help you. The questioner says, so all my questions, my search and study are of no use. Nisargadatta says, these are but the stirrings of a man who is tired of sleeping. They are not the causes of awakening, but its early signs. But you must not ask idle questions to which you already know the answers. So that kind of reminds me of Socrates in Peaceful Warrior when he tells Dan Millman, You need to learn to ask better questions, right? The questioner says, how am I to get a true answer? Nisargadatta says, just like Socrates, by asking a true question, not verbally, but by daring to live according to your lights. A man willing to die for truth will get it. Now, this kind of reminds me of what we're going through in gentle healing right now. Ever since we hit, Ephesians, Philippians, and on, and the more we go on, the stronger the message gets. What we are being asked to do is to live our clarity, right? We're asking to be mature in our faith and live our clarity. And Nisargadatta seems to be saying the same thing when he tells this man to dare to live according to your light. Right? Dare to live according to your light. Live your clarity. Don't live from ignorance. And then he says, a man willing to die for the truth will get it. If you want the truth so much that you're willing to die for it, to give up your life, which ultimately what you really give up is your false self, but it might feel like giving up your life, right? If you're willing to die for the truth, if you want it that bad, you'll get it. It's that simple. The questioner says, another question. There is the person. There is the knower of the person. There is the witness. As the knower and the witness, are the knower and the witness the same? Or are they separate states? Nisargadatta says, the knower and the witness are two or one. When the knower is seen as separate from the known, the witness stands alone. When the known and the knower are seen as one, the witness becomes one with them. So let me explain this. Let me get a drink of water first. It seems like as we practice self-inquiry and we practice awareness, watching awareness, we go through some stages, and I think they're fairly common to almost everybody. Yeah, maybe there are a few exceptions, but I think they're fairly common. What happens when we tend to first begin paying attention to awareness is I start to see that I am the knower, or I could use the words I am the observer, or I could use the words I am the witness. And I realize that everything else is the object that I witness. And I can go very deep into this because I can see that I witness the sensations in the body. I can see that I witness thought. I can see that I witness emotion. All of these things that at once I used to see as me, I now see are objects. I am the witness of the objects, right? At this point, I am the witness of the objects. We have duality, do we not? Right? I am the witness of the objects. But if we keep practicing self-inquiry, or we keep practicing awareness, watching awareness, we keep dropping backwards. And we drop back to a point that is very difficult to describe. But the best way to describe it, I guess, is to say, I am the space, and everything is a part of the space. And therefore, there's no more me and it. And so at this point, the knower, the known, and the witness are one. And so Nisargadatta says the knower and the witness are two or one. So it depends on, you know, what stage you're at in self-inquiry or in awareness, watching awareness. I have a new pal talk tonight on the Mac, and it doesn't have a clock, so it's a little, every now and then I pause and have to look at my watch or my phone to see what time it is. Usually I could just look up at the screen, but this new pal talk that has come up tonight doesn't have a time on it anywhere. The old one that I had did. So I don't know what time it is. It's a little harder to keep track of how long I'm supposed to talk. The knower and the witness are two or one. When the knower is seen as separate from the known, the witness stands alone. When the known and the knower are seen as one, the witness becomes one with them. So the questioner says, who is the Anani, which of course is the enlightened one, the witness or the supreme? Nisargadatta says, the Anani is the supreme and also the witness. He is both being and awareness. And being here would mean the I am presence or consciousness. He is both being and awareness. Awareness would be the first principle of God. Being or consciousness would be the second principle of God. He is both being and awareness. In relation to consciousness, he is awareness. In relation to the universe, he is pure being, right? So that's interesting. It depends on the relationship you're looking at. You know, if you're looking from the perspective of, if you're looking at, you know, the first principle of God and the second principle of God are directly related, but the first principle of God is not directly related to manifestation, right? The second principle of God is directly related to manifestation. So it's a relationship there. So if you're looking at manifestation, the Anani in relationship to that would be consciousness. If you're looking at consciousness, the Anani in relationship to that would be awareness. The questioner says, and what about the person? What comes first, the person or the knower? Nisargadatta says, the person is a very small thing. Actually, it is a composite. It cannot be said to exist by itself. Unperceived, it is just not there. It is but the shadow of the mind, the sum total of memories. Pure being is reflected in the mirror of the mind as knowing. What is known takes the shape of a person based on memory and habit. It is but a shadow or a projection of the knower onto the screen of the mind. So I love the fact that Nisargadatta starts that by saying the person is a very small thing, right? And I think a shadow is a very fair way to describe a person because, you know, he refers to the person as memory. If you had absolutely no memory at all, you could not identify yourself as a person. It's your memory. You have a story. You know, you get up every morning and you work out, and then you have a healthy breakfast, and then you go to work, and, you know, this is who you are, right? But that's because you remember, and not only that, it's selective memory, because I'm sure there are days you didn't work out, days you skipped breakfast, so it's even selective memory. But you know, because you have a memory, you have a definition. That limited definition is who you say you are. That selective, limited definition is who you say you are. If you had no memory, you couldn't say who you were. Have you guys ever seen the movie 50 First Dates? It's great because she had a car accident, and every day when she wakes up, she has no memory. And actually, She does remember prior to the accident, but she doesn't remember after the accident. So she doesn't remember towards the end of the movie. She's now married and has a couple of children. But when she wakes up in the morning, she's not wife. When she wakes up in the morning, she's not mother, because all of this happened after the accident, and she has no memory of being married. She has no memory of being a mother. She has to relearn that every day. So she can't define herself as that because she has no memory of it. Of course, most of us do have a memory, so we define ourselves as wife, as mother or husband, father or pet owner or whatever is appropriate. Even stupid, smart, right? That comes from a memory, and again, selective memory, how we want to see ourselves, right? So he's saying, the person is just a shadow of selective memory and definition. It has no reality at all. It's a very small thing. Why even ask about the person? It's nothing compared to reality. It's nothing not compared to reality. It's nothing. Check the watch again. Okay, good. 8 minutes. The questioner says the mirror is there, the reflection is there, but where is the sun? Nisargadatta says the supreme is the sun. The questioner says it must be conscious. Nisargadatta says it is neither conscious nor unconscious. Don't think of it in terms of conscious or unconscious. It is the life which contains both and is beyond both, right? And this is such an important point that I think we have to contemplate very, very deeply before it dawns upon us that life is everything and life is nothing. To define life is to only look at a portion of it. To put it in a box. With the first principle of God, what I often call life awareness, what NTI calls life, and what right now Nisargadatta is referring to as life, the first principle of God is absolutely beyond definition. It's everything and it's nothing. How can you define everything? And especially, well, let's look first. How can you define everything? Right? Any definition you would give it would leave out part of it. How can you define nothing? And most certainly, how can you define something that is both everything and nothing? It's absolutely beyond definition. So Nisargadatta says it is neither conscious nor unconscious. Don't think of it in terms of conscious or unconscious. And that is so important, because if you think of it in terms of conscious and unconscious, when the ego is nearing that point of ending, it's going to scream at you that the other side of this is unconscious, meaning death. Life is neither conscious nor unconscious. It is. And I apologize that that's not very descriptive, but as I've said, you can't describe it. You can contemplate it. If you contemplate it, you will come to understand it. Not in a way that you can describe it, because it can't be described, but it can be realized. It is neither conscious nor unconscious. Don't think of it in terms of conscious or unconscious. It is the life which contains both and is beyond both. Right? The life that you are is present, whether the apparent person, are conscious or unconscious, right? When you go to sleep at night into deep sleep and you are not conscious, you are still life. When you wake up and you are completely conscious, you are still life. Life cannot be defined as conscious or unconscious. It contains both and it's beyond both. The questioner says, life is so intelligent, how can it be unconscious? First of all, Nisargadatta didn't say it was unconscious, but anyway. He says, you talk of the unconscious when there is a lapse in memory. In reality, there is only consciousness. All life is conscious, and all consciousness is alive. I'm going to read this last part fairly quickly because we're almost to the end. The questioner says, even stones? And Nisargadatta says, even stones are conscious and alive. And that is most definitely true. whether people believe it or not is irrelevant. Stones are conscious and alive. The questioner says, the worry with me is that I am prone to deny existence to what I cannot imagine. Nisargadatta says, you would be wiser to deny the existence of what you can imagine. It is the imagined that is unreal. The questioner says, is all imaginable unreal? Nisargadatta says, imagination based on memories is unreal. The future is not entirely unreal. The questioner says, which part of the future is real and which is not? What do you guys think the answer is? Nisargadatta says, the future is not entirely unreal. What do you think is real about the future? That's a good question. That's a nice little puzzle. So let's get the answer to that puzzle before we close. Nisargadatta says, the unexpected is real. The unpredictable is real. What we expect and what we predict is unreal because it's imagined. So the unknown or the mystery or the unlimited potentiality is real. That's a great place to end. So Ken, I'll take a moment to contemplate a title and then I'll type it in the room. Good night, everyone.